Geopolitics, it's never felt quite so immediate, has it? Right now, the need for the European Union to expand, to really bring in those nations on its eastern and southern flanks, it feels like a matter of strategic survival and that urgency. It's almost entirely driven by Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
It really is. I mean, we are way past the point where enlargement is just some slow bureaucratic thing ticking along in Brussels. The whole European project, its foundation, is being seriously stress-tested right on its borders. And for this deep dive, we're zeroing in on two absolutely critical regions: the Western Balkans, the WB, and Moldova. Our mission really is to dig into the sources and understand, first, the huge commitments these candidate nations are making. We're talking defense contributions, democratic mandates.
Big stuff.
Huge. But then we also have to confront the friction they're up against, the systemic obstacles.
And that friction, it's palpable. You've got this stubborn procedural approach from Brussels, you know. Then there's deep internal resistance from certain EU members. And on top of that, just relentless interference from outside, from hostile states.
Exactly.
So here's the plan for today. First, we're going to unpack the Western Balkans' potential, how they might shift from being seen as a security problem to being, well, an indispensable defense provider. Then we'll dive into that long-standing enlargement bedlock. It's been stuck for years. And we'll look at the EU's new strategy for trying to fix it, which, you know, maybe has its own risks. And finally, we'll analyze Moldova's recent really strategic election victory and get into that critical debate about reforming the EU's own accession process, especially around those vetoes.
Okay, let's kick things off with the Western Balkans. And I think we need to kind of reset our perspective here. For decades, the region's been seen mostly as needing outside help, right? Think back to the Dayton Peace Accords, NATO, and Kosovo.
Feels like ancient history now, doesn't it?
It really does. The whole dynamic has fundamentally shifted. The Western Balkans are now actively positioning themselves to be providers of stability and security for the alliance.
And you can already see concrete examples. I mean, look at Albania and Montenegro, both NATO members. They're actively taking part in NATO battle groups in places like Latvia, Bulgaria.
That's right.
We're talking about, what, roughly 500 military personnel deployed pretty consistently in NATO and EU missions. And Albania specifically, they're really modernizing their military, developing dual-use logistics, things that can support NATO missions, even getting into AI technologies.
And let's not forget North Macedonia. They host these huge alliance drills at the Krivolak Range. The sources highlight it as one of NATO's top spots for major exercises. The alliance actually relies on their infrastructure.
But the really massive potential, and this really jumped out from the sources, it's the industrial capacity.
Oh, yeah.
There are something like 200 defense sector companies scattered across the region, mostly in Serbia and Bosnia and Herzegovina. And the crucial bit, they can produce ammunition that works with both NATO standards and the older, former Warsaw Pact stuff.
Which is absolutely vital for supplying Ukraine because so much of their kit is still based on those older designs.
Exactly, that compatibility is huge.
And the numbers, well, they're kind of staggering. Bosnia claims an annual production capacity for ammunition that's so large, theoretically, it could produce five times the annual target of that big new joint venture between Bulgaria's VMZ and Germany's Rheinmetall.
Wow, five times.
That's the claim. Now, if that industrial power could be properly harnessed, properly integrated, it could be a massive boost for EU supplies heading to Ukraine.
Although you did say claimed, that's the key word, right? How reliable are those figures, especially given some of the other issues we're about to get into?
That's absolutely the right question to ask. And the immediate goal, the focus right now, has to be integration, getting the Western Balkans plugged into EU support mechanisms, things like the European Defense Fund, the Security Action for Europe instrument, and the European Defense Industry Program, EDP.
EDP, right.
That's where the EU is putting aside about 1.5 billion euros in grants for 2025-2027, specifically to help streamline defense supply chains across Europe.
And we're also seeing deeper ties with the European Defense Agency, the EDA. That's the one focused on R&D and sharing capabilities, right?
Exactly. It supports member states in improving their defense capabilities. And what's interesting is Serbia was actually the first non-EU country to set up formal ties with the EDA way back in 2014.
Really? Serbia?
Yep. And now Albania and North Macedonia have signed security partnerships that specifically mention cooperating with the EDA. The sort of ideal end goal is to get all six Western Balkan countries into the EDA eventually.
But like you hinted, that whole vision runs smack into some pretty big walls. Geopolitical mistrust, deep internal problem.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the region itself is still very fractured. You've got NATO members side by side with countries hoping to join, like Kosovo and Bosnia and Herzegovina. And then there's non-aligned Serbia.
Serbia is always the complex piece.
Always. Their whole multi-vector foreign policy trying to balance things by buying equipment from Russia and China, while at the same time, slowly, maybe, moving towards Western stuff like French Rafale jets.
Well, it creates real distrust with neighbors. It makes any kind of joined-up defense planning incredibly difficult.
And that balancing act is super clear with Ukraine, isn't it? You had Russian intelligence publicly accusing Belgrade last year of secretly sending ammo to Kyiv through middlemen.
Right. And Belgrade denies any direct deals, of course. But the reporting suggests they're also kind of quietly taking credit for it, trying to play all sides or at least hedge their bets.
It's a risky game.
And maybe the biggest internal hurdle, the most corrosive one, is what the analysts call security sector capture. This is apparently a massive problem in several countries, including NATO members, Albania and Montenegro, and certainly Serbia. Security sector capture. So what does that mean exactly?
Put simply, it means the military, the intelligence services, the police, they often end up serving the interests of clientelist networks, keeping the current politicians in power, rather than actually protecting the public interest.
So they're focused inward, protecting their political buddies, maybe even working with organized crime instead of focusing outward on real security threats.
That's the dynamic. These symbiotic relationships with powerful figures, sometimes even organized crime, it fosters deep-seated corruption. And that kind of systemic rot makes genuine deep integration with EU and NATO standards, well, functionally impossible.
You can't build trust on that.
Exactly. And underlying all this is a basic economic fact. Defense spending is low, consistently under 2% of GDP across the region.
Which is way below NATO's new benchmark, isn't it? Like 3.5%.
Far short of the 3.5% agreed at the recent Hague summit. And because these are relatively small economies attracting big strategic international defense investment, it's incredibly difficult, which means joint projects between the Balkan nations themselves are probably the only realistic path forward.
All this friction, it leads us straight into the enlargement deadlock, doesn't it? Decades of frustration, you have all these high-profile summits, the Berlin process, but that big promise of membership made back in 2003 at Thessaloniki, it's basically gone nowhere. Since then, only Croatia has actually joined.
And if you look at where the six nations stand now, it's a pretty grim picture, frankly. Montenegro and Albania, okay, they seem closest. Von der Leyen even mentioned possible target dates, 2028, 2027.
Optimistic, maybe.
Perhaps. But then the sources describe Serbia as sort of anchored mid-voyage. North Macedonia is struggling to leave port. Bosnia and Herzegovina needs to be made seaworthy. And Kosovo is just completely landlocked. It's messy.
And the poster child for moving the goalposts has to be North Macedonia, right? I mean, they took the huge step in 2019 of changing their country's name, specifically to sort out the issue with Greece and unblock NATO and EU accession.
A monumental decision.
NATO, they followed through pretty quickly, but the EU? Nope. They let Bulgaria step in and veto the whole process over these, like, completely new arcane identity issues.
That kind of thing, letting internal EU politics just torpedo massive strategic reforms by a candidate country. That's exactly why support for EU membership in Serbia plummeted to an all-time low of 33%. People lose faith. Remember when former Commission President Juncker just declared no further enlargement?
Oh, yeah, that went down well.
It just killed the momentum.
Yeah.
Destroyed trust in the region.
Okay, but thankfully, the narrative seems to be shifting now, mainly because of the urgency from the war in Ukraine. The EU's rolled out this big $6 billion growth plan. It's a mix of grants and loans.
Right. The idea is to push reforms, yes, but also speed up economic convergence. There's a recognition they have to close that massive gap in income per head between the Western Balkans and the EU average. It's been decades.
So this leads to the new big idea, gradual access.
That's the core of it. The plan is to give these countries early access to bits of the EU's single market before they become full members. Think free movement of goods, maybe access to the instant payment system, digital services, financial integration.
Things people can actually feel.
Exactly. Tangible benefits now.
Yeah.
And we're already seeing some results, like roaming surcharges within the Western Balkans, gone since 2021. And now the EU is working on a plan to seriously lower data roaming prices between the EU and the Balkans.
Okay, that's practical.
Plus work on recognizing diplomas and IDs, making cross-border travel easier. It's about making the European project feel real for ordinary citizens, not just a distant political goal.
But what happens if this gradual approach doesn't work or stalls?
Well, the danger is pretty stark. You get mutual disappointment. Frustration sets in again. And that could easily push the region right back towards Russia or China, who are always waiting in the wings.
And that's compounded by the demographic issue, right?
Hugely. There's this terrifying risk of demographic collapse. Projections show the region could lose 3 million people. That's like 17% of the current population by 2050.
17%.
That statistic alone just shows you the depth of the structural problems they face, which, frankly, makes the urgency of this EU pivot totally understandable. But on a slightly more positive note, the latest Balkan Barometer survey, it shows support for EU membership is back up to 64%, highest it's been in a decade. So maybe there's still hope.
Okay, let's pivot now. Let's shift gears and head east to Moldova, because Europe just notched up a really crucial win there. The parliamentary election on September 28th, 2025. It was really framed as this make-or-break test for democracy, especially with all the Russian pressure.
And the pro-European side absolutely came through. The Party of Action and Solidarity, PAS, they secured a single-party majority, got 50.2% of the vote. That translates to 55 out of 101 seats.
So a clear mandate.
A very clear mandate.
Yeah.
It completely dwarfed the pro-Russian patriotic electoral bloc, which only got about 24%.
Mm-hmm.
And the crucial thing is, PAS can now govern alone. They don't need to get into messy coalitions with incompatible anti-European partners.
What's really striking, though, is the sheer scale of Russia's interference attempts. The sources list the whole toolkit.
Everything but the kitchen sink.
Right. Illegal funding, constant cyber attacks, huge disinformation campaigns, widespread vote buying, even bomb threats on election day, apparently targeting embassies and places where Moldovans abroad vote because that's where EU support is strongest.
Yeah, it was intense. So the PAS victory isn't just a win for Moldova. It's being called a pretty significant defeat, maybe even a humiliation for Vladimir Putin.
But the threat hasn't gone away, has it? The vulnerabilities are still there.
Definitely not gone. The Kremlin's long-term game isn't just about winning one election. It's about constantly eroding trust in institutions, trying to derail that European path over time. You still have pro-Russian figures, like the former president Igor Dodon, calling for protests to annul the election results, and the oligarch Ilan Shor. He's still active, despite being under sanctions.
So Russia still has levers to pull.
Oh, yeah. Potent ones. Disinformation is ongoing. They exploit corruption networks. Energy remains a vulnerability, especially in the breakaway region of Transnistria, plus issues around disputed infrastructure ownership, unsettled energy contract debts. They have ways to apply pressure.
And Moldova is, what, Europe's poorest economy? But it's an EU candidate now, moving really fast.
At record speed. And the EU knows exactly what's at stake. They poured in over $250 million just in emergency energy support. And crucially, they integrated Moldova into the main European electricity grid, ENTSE.
Ah, ENTSE. That's the system coordinating power across Europe.
Exactly. It basically gives Moldova energy security, a lifeline away from Russian energy blackmail. Plus, Moldova is also getting support from that $1.9 billion reform and growth facility, similar to the Western Balkans.
So this all brings us back to that core tension, doesn't it? Geopolitics versus proceduralism. Russia's invasion finally kicked enlargement back onto the main stage. Suddenly, Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia get candidate status. Accession talks finally open for Albania and North Macedonia. The geopolitical need seems blindingly obvious.
It does. But when you actually analyze the language coming out of the EU, the high-level speeches from von der Leyen, the manifestos from the European Parliament parties, you see this deep internal conflict. Yes, the rhetoric is warmer, lots of talk about the European family.
Right.
But the operational framing, how they talk about actually doing it, it remains overwhelmingly procedural. It's all step-by-step, conditional, strictly merit-based, no shortcuts.
And the research backs that up strongly.
Very strongly. The analysis showed nearly 4 out of 5 of von der Leyen's big enlargement speeches, and literally every single EP party manifesto they looked at stressed that progress depends entirely on meeting all the accession criteria in full. It feels like a real disconnect with the geopolitical urgency.
Yeah, it does.
And there's a risk that the initial post-invasion rhetorical high point might already be fading. Von der Leyen's 2025 State of the Union address apparently barely touched on enlargement. And at the same time, you see internal roadblocks going up again, like Hungary openly threatening to veto Ukraine's accession.
Which is exactly why the experts are saying the process needs to be credible, not just procedural. Yeah. The EU needs to adapt. Conditionality, okay, but it has to be linked to a bigger strategic vision, not just ticking boxes.
And incremental rewards are key. Things like that earlier market access we talked about. Something tangible to keep countries motivated, prevent that candidate fatigue from setting in again.
But the elephant in the room seems to be the veto, the single member obstruction.
That's the critical structural failure they need to tackle. The courses argue the EU can't keep dodging the debate about using qualified majority voting QMV, at least for the interim steps in the enlargement process.
Okay, so QMV, just to remind ourselves, that basically means a decision passes if a certain majority of member states, representing a certain majority of the EU population, agree. It stops one single country from blocking everything.
Precisely. The current system, requiring total unanimity for many steps, is just too risky now. It sets up this potential hostage situation. Especially if you link Moldova and Ukraine's progress, one member could block both.
Which just locks in the same kind of deadlock we've seen in the Western Balkans, but on an even bigger, more dangerous scale, sacrificing strategy for procedure.
That's the fear.
So what we've seen in this deep dive is pretty clear. You have countries on the EU's edge making huge, sometimes painful, commitments. Dedicating defense capacity, choosing democracy, even when under attack.
Massive commitments.
But the EU's own internal machinery, its reliance on rigid procedures and unanimity, risks completely fumbling this major geopolitical opportunity that, ironically, Russia's aggression created.
So if the EU keeps saying its session has to be strictly merit-based, which sounds fair enough, but then allows one member state to unilaterally block progress that has been merited, what's the real price of that unanimity? Especially now, in a time of such urgent geopolitical need.
What's the actual risk to Europe of failing to make that European choice, the choice made by Moldova, by the Western Balkans, a solid, irreversible reality for their people? That, I think, is the question we want to leave you with today.